episode 5 of the Exit Strategy. We dive into what VCs are looking for in pitch deck post-COVID. India is still growing with Samsung and Apple with expansion plans in the region. L'Oreal acquisition of Skin Better Science. Now let's hear the count.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to the Exit Strategy, a podcast that inspires open discussions about financial news and technology today. My name, Marcus Megarian, a recovering SaaS vendor, joined by my co-hosts, Ralph DeFiore and Swadek Mazumdar. And we're sitting down with startup founders, technology experts. Now let's begin. We're glad you're back to hear us speak. We're here with my favorite two amigos to make us together, the three amigos. Ralph, Swadek, how are you guys today?
I'm great. Getting ready for a hurricane down here in Florida. I got my shutters locked and loaded.
this is Swadek Mazumdar. How you doing? Hunker down there, Ralph, while we hunker down from the onslaught of the market.
I can guarantee you guys absolutely. That there's no hurricanes here in Paris, France. But the only hurricanes I keep seeing is on the news channels these days. We're seeing inflation worries and markets keep dropping, the British pound taking a tanking. But positive news, factory jobs are back. We're booming like it's 1970s. You guys got your bell bottoms on or?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's great news. That's great news. And hopefully the Midwest is benefiting from that because they certainly need it.
The funnest news is this Snowden guy getting a Russian passport. I want to see him run as Putin's candidate, VP of the country or something like that. Just
right. Can you imagine?
I want to see him hack the system the way he did with the NSA here in the States.
Right. maybe he'll try to leave the country like the rest of the young people who are trying to get out before the military drafts them.
I could tell you that in Paris, it's still the city of love. It's the city. It's also becoming the city of deals. So it's fascinating how every week there's another conference. There's always somebody starting something. I mean, it's incredible what people are doing here. And it's no different in the United States. I mean, we're seeing about a 30% increase in the number of decks that are being sent out. So there's more startups than there are exits these days. And it's consistently startup. We should call this planet no longer Planet Earth. We call it a planet startup.
Well, yeah. You know, that gets back to what somebody told me about manufacturing, that they'd rather invest in an internet company or some technology than a manufacturing company because the technology had the ability to grow so much faster and so much higher. So, technology, let's put it this way, technology is more appreciated today by more people than ever before.
I think the ability to start a company is much easier these days. There's so many more platforms and channels. Even graduating business school in 2007, you didn't have this startup pitch nation that exists today. It started maybe like 2-3 years after, around like 2009, 2010, and really took off in the mid 2010s. And then today, I mean, from 2021 to 2022, it's up 30%. I mean, that's an incredible number. You know, we use the same systems that are used to track all these things. I mean, we were looking here on a sample of 320 pitch decks, and the numbers are clear. I mean, more people are looking to do startups. Here in Paris, every week, we have a new conference. If it's retail tech or payment tech, or if this today was the AI data tech conference, I don't know.
Yeah, piggybacking off on what Ralph said and you kind of alluded to, I think the startup world will always evolve. There's more happening from a technology point of view, so there's more irons in the fire, so to speak, to work on. And for a company to get to an MVP level, it takes much lesser time and limited resources, capital-wise. And that's why you're seeing this whole startup world really picking up. And it'll continue to do so, in my view.
There's a lot of piggybacking in the business now, and you're right. It's a lot easier because now you could start a product and API from somebody else. Ralph and I worked on a project last year where we were working as buy-side advisors, and it was very easy to see that some of the tech companies were simply just APIing these existing platforms and calling it their own. It's a different world, and it really becomes like who's the better spokesman, right? Because the one who could pitch the best or could impress people the best, they're the ones that are going to be winning the money. And winning the money gives you the advertising dollars and the growth equity that you need in order to get these companies going.
No, sure. Storytelling is a big part of raising the capital, but ultimately the one that wins is a better product, more traction in the market, better technology. Those are the things that really wins. In the beginning, storytelling obviously opens a lot of doors, but sooner or later, I think whether you have a startup ecosystem that's really building or has been built up, sooner or later, you can always separate the good from the bad. And that happens pretty quickly nowadays. This old Silicon Valley mantra, fail fast, fail cheap.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I always tell people at these conferences that a lot of people use pretty much the same rules. I mean, you need a database to store your product. If you're like a MarTech company, you need to do a line of JavaScript, which tags on to the JavaScript of a web browser when it loads up. And, it really becomes who's controlling the data, like who controls that first party data. And many of these tech startups, especially when they're starting from nothing, really have very limited data. And if you're doing something in the financial space, you have a lot of sensitive data. If you're in the healthcare space, you have even more sensitive data with extreme protections. So every data company, especially in today's conference that I went to, it was really about where are you sourcing your data from? Because if you don't have the pipe that brings that data, forget about it. When I go to these today in this data conference, it really felt like a lot of the people were doing the same thing. And they all say they do something different. And it's always the same. You collect the data, you have to put it somewhere. And then you retrieve it, like if you use a Bloomberg, you retrieve the data from that source. And really everyone's just APIing off each other in the end. And then you have this massive connectivity with everybody. Like if you want to have connectivity with social media platforms, you'll API with Facebook or Instagram or now with TikTok. If you want to integrate with financial platforms, you'll go to Reuters or the Bloomberg terminal. It's become very homogenized, like very normalized everything. And people are, they come out of college knowing how to do all this. And a lot of these platforms are built while people are in school, because you could build the technology like a SaaS technology usually in your dorm room. You can't build SpaceX in your dorm room, And it's Swatek, you've ever dreamed about building a spaceship or...
Not at all. I'd rather ride in one than build one. talking about data, I think the storage of data has become very cheap. If we go back 20 years, there wasn't this amount of data that's out there. But today, everything we do, be it drive a car or be on a phone or interact with social media, it is generating some sort of data. And that data is being mined for different variety of reasons. And the companies have the ability to do that is just because of storage. Storage becomes so cheap. I mean, rack space today, AWS is a huge component of Amazon's success, right? And it came out like an accident. It was really an accident, to be very honest. It wasn't part of the roadmap. They didn't think, okay, we're going to do AWS. But today they're making billions every quarter just on AWS because everything has become so cheap. And that's why I think data is evolving this quickly, for, obviously a variety of reasons, but I think for the cheapness and storage as well, it's getting ubiquitous.
I mean, they even said that if AWS separates from Amazon, it'd become one of the most profitable companies or the one of the biggest market cap companies in the Fortune 100. It could even
Yeah.
be higher market cap than Amazon, supposedly.
Right. The person who's running AWS now, or running Amazon now, really started AWS. That was his brainchild. And now he's running Amazon.
So, I mean, because it's crazy. We keep looking through the news here. I mean, I'm sharing my screen with you guys. I don't know if you can actually see what I'm browsing through, but I keep looking through everything, and there's very limited things that are happening. Like, what's going on with this market? I mean, like, you have the markets are ups and downs everywhere. The DAX is down, the FTSE is up, the French CAC 40 is down. I don't know. I mean, the hottest place in the market that I see now is India, and that's Swadesh's domain.
So there has been a lot of newer companies that have come in, Paytm being one of them,
Yeah.
right? It's for most of it was targeted mostly for non-banking consumers, but now everybody's being brought into the from the digital world. That's the greatest thing about this new policies that's been created by the government. Everybody has to be banked. Everybody has to be in the digital banking space somehow. Since you're looking at the fintech space, what I would suggest you look at RuPay. It's RuPay, which is basically backed by the Indian government, right? It's the National Payment Corporation of India, and
Yeah.
this is basically something that the RBI, which is Reserve Bank of India, which is obviously a government entity, wanted a domestic open, multi-layered payment system. And RuPay today is giving Visa and MasterCard a run for their money. They have about 30% on a volume, or 34% based on volume. They have a market share, and that's fantastic. The government obviously is subsidizing, but they're using something where you have to, I forget the term, where you have to pay the a merchant discount rate, the MDR, which you have to
Yeah.
pay to the merchant. They're eliminating that now so that people, more and more people, use RuPay instead of Visa and MasterCard, because they feel if you're paying Visa and MasterCard, that 2 or 3% merchant value is going to Visa and MasterCard. It does not help anybody. And it's discouraging a lot of consumers from using it. So they want to do a domestic open multi-layered system to promote that. And if you take out the merchant credit or the merchant discount rate, it's a win-win for both situations.
Marcus, I think it'd be great to mention when we're talking about credit cards in India. This is from that TechCrunch article you sent us,
Yeah.
and it's Samsung launches credit card in India. And there's something else in there that's pretty interesting. It says Indian fintech Slice launches $27 credit limit cards to tap 200 million users. This is getting, and then it says even as there are hundreds of millions of Indians who have bank accounts, only about 30 million have credit cards. That's amazing if you think of the population of India, and if this is accurate, only 30 million of them have credit cards, because the middle class in India is equal to about our population, right?
More.
More.
Yeah. Almost middle class would be closer to 400 or 500 million. It's almost half the
Wow. And then you
population, yeah.
have to ask what the definition of middle class means in India.
Yeah, so I would say anyone with about $14,000 in annual income.
All right. And
Wow.
Brazil, it was 10,000.
Yeah.
Because supposedly, once you get above 10,000, you could afford a laptop, and then it allows you to work from home and, go to school with a laptop and all those things.
I see a lot of changes in India. When we look at articles such as as these, this sounds more like an ad for Samsung more than an article written by whoever's authored that Manish thing. It's this seems more like them talking about what they're doing as an offering. But if you look at the amount that they talk about, we should not, we should not misinterpret it, as the smaller amount. I think we should look at the aspect of creating certain habits to buy, right? Similar to when we buy a house here, the mortgage interest rate that you pay, you can write off. Recently the government capped that, but earlier on, if you had a mortgage interest rate of 50,000, you wrote that off. So the point of you paying off the mortgage was not very prudent,
Yeah.
right?
Here
In India, it's
in
different,
France,
but it's coming around now.
you can't deduct it in France. You can't even deduct it in Brazil. I mean, it just depends. It's very crazy credit here in a place like France, because like you could only whatever your post-tax income is, you could only borrow in the amount that would equate to a third of that value. So if you made 10,000, your tax rate's 50%, you have 5,000, you could get a third of that. That's how much mortgage you could take out. So it's like impossible for like housing prices to go up. If in India allows you to deduct, it allows you to increase the value of housing, because
No,
then you have.
what you're saying is very conservative, and I think that's the way to, just to increase housing, you are putting people more in debt. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. But I think that's why like the inflation here in France is still 2%. In the United States it's like 7, 10, and like the it's just crazy. Like I believe that pumping up or juicing up markets too much, it's great in the short term, but eventually you got to pay the piper eventually.
Absolutely. And that's where coming back to this conversation full circle, that's where I think the pound is falling. I think people, the
Yeah.
confidence level is being eroded. Having them seen what happened in the US, 5 years, where we pumped so much money into the economy. And yes, it was disco time. People had a lot of fun. And now people are paying for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think India is doing the right stuff with this. Apple is going to manufacture there. Samsung's going to manufacture there. Samsung with the credit card. I know that like in the United States, as I said, in Texas, we had something that we were doing in Taylor, Texas, which was like 200-acre plots of land, basically within a 5 mile drive of where the Samsung factory is going to be. So I don't know if some of this inflation also has to do with a lot of factories and companies going back to the United States, but it's definitely creating a lot of opportunities both in the United States and in India, all this technology move.
Well, so from an Apple perspective, I think they need another option than just China.
Yeah.
With all obviously with the geopolitical issues, and we've seen supply chain, we've seen COVID issues.
Yeah.
It's not sustainable. So they want and the Indian government, I would give them credit for that as well. They see the need of the day. They're giving subsidies. They're trying to be very competitive. India does have talent. It has labor, and wages are very competitive. I think there was an article I read somewhere where it said 5% of Apple sales or equipment sales will be out of China, out of India, 5% off. So they're taking basically 5% out of China, and by 2025, that's going to be 25%. That's huge. If that be the case, that has to be a huge scale up in India. A
Yeah.
lot of investments would be going there. That's certain things that we should look into as well.
I mean, $31 a month, it's basically a dollar a day. So obviously, if you could survive on a dollar a day, it's You know, it's what's needed probably for the 200 million people that do not have access to a credit card.
Yeah, so this is just a start, you know. So like I keep saying, and this is to create the habit. If you make this little challenging, people are not going to use it. They want to make sure that people use it, they get into habit, they know what it means, they know how to leverage, they know how the payment cycles work, they know how the, you know, the bill payment cycle, you know, bills work. Earlier on it was cash. You had $10, you spent $10, you didn't have $10, you didn't spend $10. Yeah. Now the $31 is really for the lowest people on the food chain to support that. And then, you know, as you go higher, it's going to be, you know, I have friends in India that spend $31 in a second, forget a month, in a microsecond. And that embarrasses me at times because, you know, they are paying equivalent to what you would pay for a drink, say, in Manhattan, without even flinching. That's right. Crazy. Let's go on a real quick funner topic since Marcus is in France. Talk about the French fashion a little bit, real quick, and you know.
Well, I mean, it's a tough circuit here. I mean, look, there's if we want to talk about that, hold on one second. Right, here we go. So in L'Oreal recently just signed an agreement to acquire Skin Better, which is a cosmetic company. I mean, since the wife here works at L'Oreal, I mean, she was talking about it all day the other day. And the truth is, I'm just not an expert in the space. I told you, we do fintech and maybe MarTech tech companies, but it is an American company. You know, with using cutting-edge dermatological science, combining patent-efficient ingredients with luxury sensorial textures. Now, do you guys wear any face creams?
I think Ralph does. I don't. Ralph?
Don't wear any face cream.
he was very slow on responding.
So this is one of those... I have myself on mute. I don't have what drives... my family crazy is I don't use any shaving cream when I shave.
Yeah, me neither.
To me, it's a bother. It's a bother. And the razors now have that coating that lets the razor just glide across your face. You don't need the shaving cream.
Yeah. No, but I mean, they basically paid one-time revenue for this. So the company makes around $95 million in trailing 12-month revenues. And, you know, these kinds of products, no matter what happens, I know this is a fact. When you work in the cosmetic sector, the last thing that people start to buy, and particularly women, are products that are going to be age-defying. And one thing, since we're very close to actually, because a lot of the people that work at L'Oreal, the CEO of the global CEO, the US, the America CEO, they're all alumni. So I've actually been to the offices for events. And they won't buy a company unless it's worth at least $100 million. You know, it's in the for a company like L'Oreal, I mean, their main driver is going to be to acquire companies in order to add to their ecosystem because they have a massive portfolio. I mean, that's what also makes them the number one cosmetic company on the planet. But it's it's obviously a very good buy if you have recurring revenue of $100 million. You know. And it fits very well with their bold ventures play.
You know. Yeah, the healthcare space, obviously is in the forefront, whether it's France or America or anywhere else. Yeah. That whole industry has, you know, done very well. And even with depressed markets, it'll continue. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a marginal shift, but it'll continue to grow.
Oh, and this place is a powerhouse. I mean, like especially the division that bought the product, the company was the Active Cosmetic Wear. The Active Cosmetic Wear is their highest cash flow entity within the company. It's what sells all the products in Active Cosmetics sell in the pharmacies. They sell, the lower price point products. They're the more commonly used products. So obviously, if they get into this ecosystem, $100 million today becomes 500 million tomorrow. You know, they have the they got the distribution network, they got the best D2C people available in the market. You know, headquarters in New York, headquarters in Paris. I only see positive movements for this. Not ever having owned a share of any cosmetic company myself, but I'm sure it'll be very positive for them.
Yeah, I would say so. I guess below 100 million doesn't move the needle for them.
No. You know, when we were working with one of the funds that we were advising, we went to visit the head of Bold Ventures in New York. And the person in charge of it now is the old global CEO who now became chairman. You know, if you're a multi-billion dollar company, for you to do an investment on like a $5 million company, it's like you don't have time. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what happened to the most of the conglomerates that came out of the 60s. You know, you can't pay attention to all the different businesses. They all have different dynamics and different capital needs. So it's hard to, although there is, who is it? Lowe's, I think, is a conglomerate. They own something to do with cattle, and they own Jefferies, the brokerage house. I think I got it right. Or maybe it's somebody else. I should look that up.
Well,
I don't think it's just dollar value at times that we have to look at. We have to look at the overall strategy as to, a lot of times these companies acquire certain companies to fill a certain gap. You know, so the overall strategy might be different as well.
I could tell you that with a cosmetic company or a fashion company, you usually want to keep freshening up the brand. Like if you go to a Coty, they still have brands like the Beyoncé perfume, and a celebrity who was maybe at her prime like a decade ago. And there's a bunch of things that these companies do that only last a certain amount of time. I mean, there was a Netflix show about this majorly successful fashion designer. I think his name was Halston or something, and he was huge. But when I watched the show on Netflix, I had no idea who this guy was. When I Googled him, he was a beast in the market. You know.
Yes, he was. He was. I think he just died a few years ago. He was big. He was very big. Yeah.
It's like Bill Blass. It was like the biggest thing in the 80s. Never heard of Bill Blass until one of my friends went to work there. So things die. You have to keep refreshing everything. You know, everything's a work in progress. I mean, like, look, I mean, you have companies like the Nintendo Corporation, which used to be like a card playing game, and now they do video games. And then you have like Nokia, which was a timber company, which now is one of the biggest, you know, electronics companies on the planet. It's all about pivoting.
Yeah.
If you stay stuck in something, it's eventually going to die out. I mean, look what happened to Kodak or BlackBerry.
Yep, that's true. That's true. You know, but again, like, yes, you have to be fresh, and you've got to evolve and, you know, fill in those gaps. That's what these guys are doing.
All right. Well, guys, do you think we should call it today?
I think that's a good idea.
A good idea. Well, everybody, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Like, subscribe, share, tell your friends. Any last words, Swadek or Ralph?
No, I'm just waiting to get some feedback from Ralph to see how we can navigate this market. He's a pro at this.
This was episode 5 of The Exit Strategy. Catch us next week for episode 6, where we have Mark Kepenagian speaking to us about Cryptown, a French listing service that helps startups raise capital and go public.